Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in studio right now is candidate for the 1st Congressional District, Republican Jack Bergman. Jack, welcome back to Copper Country Today.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you.
You know, it was, six months ago, but I was sitting down here with some guy I never met before named Jack Bergman that was running for the Republican nomination up against two well-known, people and that are known in our local politics. And lo and behold, when we were sitting here doing our live broadcast show, me and a couple of other gentlemen, Tony Pinter and Tony Peasy, we saw these results coming back, and it wasn't like it was a comeback victory. It was, you started to pace out ahead, and that just, the lead grew, and lo and behold, at the end of the night, the people chose you. How does that feel?
Well, it feels great. And it feels great because of the fact that the people who chose to vote on August 2nd, I think they took a long look at all three candidates, and I was very pleased that that they chose me because, again, they did some investigation.
Now, you're going to be going up against a couple of other opponents, of course, Democrat Lon Johnson, and then they have a Libertarian candidate in this race, Diane Bosto. Do you spend much time reading up on your opponents, or do you just go out there and do your own thing?
That would be like asking a Marine if they studied their adversary.
Well, I would assume they would.
They would. I like to get to know who I'm interacting with, whether I'm with them or against them.
We're going to talk a little bit more as that goes on, but I would also imagine that you put on a lot of miles on your car during this time. It's a big district. You've been talking to a lot of people. What are you hearing?
I'm hearing the fact that people are frustrated, disappointed, in some cases angry, with what their politicians, their elected officials, their folks who've been inside the party have been, the output that they're getting from them. And the folks aren't happy. They don't think they're getting their money's worth.
Well, are they giving you some specifics on what to tackle?
Well, specifics, short answer is it's different in different parts of the district. But number one, everybody in the district wants more jobs. Everybody in the district wants some type of relief from the regulations. It's one thing to want relief from taxes. It's another thing when businesses and people employed by those businesses are saying, hey, just let us do our business. We're doing it right. We're being responsible. Get off our back.
Okay. You are, of course, big on the veterans issues, and we talked about these at length last time we were here. You're in Northern Michigan talking to veterans there as well. Specifically with those issues, what are you looking at?
Well, number one, veterans deserve and should get and must get every benefit that they rate. But they must get it in a timely manner and in a quality manner. The bureaucracy in getting an appointment for care or getting an appointment for some type of other help when it comes to everything from health care to a VA loan. Let me give you an example. We don't have enough of a population density up here of housing, so if a young veteran applies for a loan, there's not enough comparables. We need to have an adjustment in how VA loans are granted by the banks. If they need 5 comparables, maybe for a veteran, maybe you only need 2. We just don't have the housing density up here. From the health care side, we need to make sure that the Veterans Choice Program actually works. And we've had some problems in the area here. There's some folks from Ontonagon told me a few months ago about the fact that the care was provided. But in the end, the bill was sent to the veteran, and the provider didn't get paid. What's wrong with that? So there's issues, and it's largely related to a multi-layered bureaucracy in which the left hand isn't talking to the right hand. So I would suggest to you, in some cases, some people might say the solution is, we'll get the right hands talking. I think maybe we need to maybe eliminate one of the hands and just let it be handled by one of them.
A few weeks ago, I had a public relations guy from the VA here, and they have a lot of great programs at the VA Med Center. And really, as we always, kind of talk to them, is, all right, you have all of these different services that you're offering, but yet I can stop almost any veteran not walking down the street. Oh, my VA doesn't provide me anything, or it's so hard to get care, or it's so far away to go, so far to go and get care. And it's that gap of trying to get those veterans connected with the services that are available.
We've made it too complicated for the veterans. Now, veterans in an urban area may not find it complicated at all because they've got great internet infrastructure. They've got their cell phones. Where we live up here, I drove up here today from Watersmeet. I made about 12 calls. Four of them were dropped because of the fact that I was going through a black hole. So when you think about that and the lack of internet service, we all now, no matter whether it's veterans or any other issue we're dealing with, most times we're probably going to have to go to a website, get online, type in a password, we have to create an account, and a lot of our folks just don't have internet. So, well, that solution, that type of information, digital-based solution, may work for the majority of the folks in urban areas. It doesn't work up here. So we've got to do something different. I got some plans.
Does that include investing in improving broadband services and making it more available?
Absolutely. We have to have that up here because not only is it important for the individuals to be able to connect. I ran into a young lady the other day who was interviewing me about why I had a check from Louisiana that I donated to a campaign account up here. I said, did you ever try live in a place where you had a house, and we have a winter home. We get out of here for a little bit of time in the winter and go to Louisiana. I know that some people wanted to make that more of a deal than it was, but the point is, I said, did you ever try to cash an out-of-town check in a small town? She goes, what's a check? This girl is 28 years old. She does all her banking online. She doesn't even know what a checkbook is. So when you think about the expectations of what people have and then where we are, in largely whether it's lack of infrastructure, rural hospitals, all of those things that are unique, especially here in the Western UP, we have to have procedures and policies that allow us as the exception to be able to function with the norm. Easier said than done, but not impossible.
And not cheap with some of the
items. Not cheap, but you know, if you really... We waste so much money in government these days at all levels, but let's just talk about the federal level. And if you don't understand budgeting, you know, I was responsible for literally just under $1 billion a year budget for my last 4 years. I understand what it's like to create a budget. I understand what it's like to argue for and defend a budget. And then when you finally get your numbers to execute that budget, so many folks, and I would suggest to you maybe some of my peers and competitors really have no clue what it's like to be on both ends of that scale.
I was going to save it for later, but since you've already brought it up, we have to kind of tackle the 800-pound gorilla in the room because, it is an odd argument to see play out, and it plays out in ads and social media things, and sometimes I won't call them more than low blows, but you have two candidates in the race that both are charging each other with not being from the area. You know, address your side. I know you can't address Lon Johnson's portion of it, but you know, a lot of people, you know, have made the accusation that, you know, he has very weak ties to Northern Michigan, and he'll defend that and say that that's not true. But at the same time, that's a volley he's firing your way. And you mentioned New Orleans, so why don't you go ahead and explain your position on it?
Well, bottom line is, the government, by the way, moved me and my wife to New Orleans when they moved us from Washington, D.C. So we were there courtesy of the United States government sending us there to command the largest force-level organization in the Marine Corps, 100,000 people. We got there 2 months before Katrina. That was 2005. That's a story for another time on that leadership experience. During that time down there, we found a place in the woods between Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Natchez, Mississippi, which reminded us exactly of what we drive in going down Cisco Lake Road, going into our house here in Watersmeet. Double canopied, two-lane asphalt road, and in the woods. And you know what? My wife said, I think this is the warm weather place. I'd like to have some coffee out on the deck in January where I can't do it in Watersmeet. So the point is, yeah, we have a little home in Louisiana.
That's probably a nice place.
It's a nice place, yeah. And it's in the woods. And on any given day, if I go play a round of golf at one of the courses down there, I can take three things with me. My golf clubs, my fishing rod, because most of these places have ponds with good fish in them. Of course, we name the fish different. The fish, same fish are named different things in different parts of the country, which I didn't understand. And also my shotgun, because we can hunt.
Now, if any reporter from the state of Louisiana or here from Michigan were, you know, was asking about your Michigan home, say, how do you like living there? Would you ever give it anything other than a lot of praise?
Where, Louisiana or Michigan?
Either one.
We chose both. I mean, I chose the UP 35 years ago, and my grandparents chose the UP in the 1880s. You know, I tell them we're relatively new to the UP. My parents got here in the 1880s, not 1980s, 1880s.
All right, let's switch things off from veterans issues over to education. There's a lot of ideas on how to improve education and how much states should have the power to determine what kind of curriculum they're going to run, what rules are they going to set, versus what nationally they're looking for, Common Core, those type of issues. How do you feel this should be, you know, the balance of power there between Washington and Michigan?
Yeah, pretty much zero Washington, 100% Michigan.
Really?
Yeah, truly. The education department was an experiment that's gone bad. It's failed. It is absolutely failed. It's not even outcome-based, because when they do all the Common Core and the assessing, they're not assessing what the kids can actually do. They're assessing how the teachers teach it, how they score on the tests. Well, if you're going to employ somebody, you really don't care how well they did on their tests. You want to know if they can comprehend the instruction manual of the computer they're running for the manufacturing facility that you own. Education system at the federal level is a failure. Shut down. I'm going to repeat this. Shut down the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. Get rid of Common Core. Let the states determine their education system. Why do you think charter schools have gotten, you know, traction and are succeeding? It's because the public education system has gotten off track. And I'll put it out there to the teachers' unions, because my daughter was a former member of the union, teachers' union in Illinois, and she got fed up. The point is, as an airline pilot, every year our airline pilots play what we call You Bet Your Job. We went, in my case, to Minneapolis because I flew for Northwest. We went to Minneapolis for 4 days every year to do written testing, oral testing, classroom instruction, and finally a simulator test. If we couldn't pass any of those, we didn't get a paycheck. What do we do with a teacher who absolutely is not performing in the classroom when it comes to the outcomes of the students and they can read and write? The union has to ask themselves that. And if a teacher can't perform, don't make them an administrator.
Well, are we giving enough funding for education to make so that teachers can perform and do their jobs?
Well, again, if you take it out of the federal level and bring it into the state level, whole different metric. So it's the state's obligation. I would suggest to you, when you look at the funding per student up in this part of the country, in the state, as opposed to what we're paying down in Detroit, we're paying a lot more and getting a lot less down there. It's about accountability for the people who are in charge of the system. The more layers you have when you go from local to state to federal, the more chance you have of flex in the system that doesn't lead to an outcome. The outcome has to be that student's ability to read, to write, to comprehend. We used to call it read and write and arithmetic, right?
Yeah.
Well, the bottom line is, you still have to be able to read, you still have to be able to write, but I'd some cases change the arithmetic, although some people can't add without a calculator, and they can't make change if you give them whatever. I won't even go down that road. But the idea is, I would say it's reading, writing, and comprehending, because our youngsters, if they're going to become functional adults rather than being fed by the flat screen, they need to be able to comprehend. That's what we need.
You were talking about budgeting, spending. That's, of course, it's going to be one of the major issues you and anybody else that gets sent to Washington is going to have to tackle. We've got a massively growing federal deficit. We have that, and we have things like Social Security, and we have our welfare, we have other, you know, things that we're spending money on, entitlements. What would you do to fix all that? Would you even have a suggestion?
Well, number one, from the federal spending level, those departments who spend money, this is not even talking about entitlements or Social Security or Medicare, that's a totally different ball of wax. But when you're talking about federal governments who have a budget line, they're a budget line item in the federal government. And let's say right now with baseline budgeting, now, let's say a department's budget was $1 million a year. They just assume they're going to start with $1 million, and then maybe next year they'll do $1.2 million, and you know they trump up some reason as to why they need an extra $200,000. We got to get rid of the baseline budgeting, go to zero-based budgeting. which basically says you have to justify what it is your department is doing from the ground up every year. You don't start with a baseline, because that is the only way we're going to get departments to actually cut the things, the processes, and in some cases it's a few jobs, of what they're doing today that no longer adds value. You have to stop it. That's what good businesses do. To use one example, the federal government, because I used to see it in the military, we had jobs for filing clerks. Their job was to take that piece of paper, put it in a manila envelope, stick it in a drawer, make sure it was alphabetized. With the information age and everything digital, how many jobs do you think going forward are there for professional filing clerks?
I talked to somebody just this week who is pretty sure that, and this is somebody who's nearing retirement age, that her and her husband will not make it to the end of their lives before they no longer have Social Security. They believe that it's just not going to be there anymore. Is what can be done?
Well, number one, if you plan to live past roughly 2032, 2033 with what the projections are now, so that's what, another 16 years thereabouts, 17 years? Yeah. The math says pot's dry. If we don't reform Social Security so that, and it's quite honestly, it's pretty late for some of the folks. We have to ensure that, let's say anyone over 50 today will not have a cut in their benefits during their lifetime, because they're at an age where they really can't recover. If you think of it as just a personal investment plan, the older you get, the less risk you should assume in your personal investment plan, because you don't have time to recover, so you have to play it a little safer. But we have to look long-term about how we create a personalized program, kind of like in the defined contribution plan, which is another term for 401ks, people have control over their investments. I'd really like to find anybody who can name me one program the government has ever run that has been really a financial success that you'd invest in. I think it'd be pretty hard to put your name on one.
So is it correct to say then that's privatization of Social Security?
No, I don't think it's privatization. Well, people get all excited about words. People say, well, privatization, you're going to give it to the Wall Street bankers. No. If you have a savings plan, wouldn't it be nice to be able to get 4 or 5% on a passbook savings account at a bank? That's what we used to do. I transitioned my parents, who used to keep their money before World War II in a sock. They made a big step in about 1947 and actually got a checking account. In the early 1960s, I talked my mom and dad into getting a credit card. You'd have thought that I had created something that was so from Mars. Now, when I said earlier today about the young lady I met who had no idea what a check was. So when you think about going forward and what we is the right thing to do, we need to get the government out of so many businesses that it's not competent in running.
I remember sitting in high school, this would be about almost 30 years ago, and my government teacher, as I look back at it, was probably very much a right-leaning teacher compared to what normally you would get in a teacher, just some of the things that she taught. And you know, she taught the class, this would be in the late 80s, that her students in that class, when we would graduate, would not have Social Security because it would be run out. And what just strikes me about that is that, okay, that was 30 years ago. So, you know, it's sort of like when people call for climate change and global warming. If it ever does get to that point, it's not because it didn't come with any kind of warning. There's been some warning here with Social Security. It's a can you can only kick so far down the road, and then it's either the bottom drops out. You can't just continue doing things the way it's always been done. At least I can definitely see that. So that's why I wanted to ask that. Immigration. This is Michigan, where yet we find ourselves to be a premier destination for refugees from the Middle East, and welcome to those that need a place to live. Especially when you look at the national ticket for president, there is different viewpoints on down from there all the way down on what should be done, what steps should be taken to ensure people's safety. I imagine you've got a unique perspective from having served in the military.
Well, you know, there's two parts of that question. Number one, a good, solid immigration policy for our country has three elements. Number one, we agree, whoever the we is, how many, a finite number of people should be allowed to come in through our immigration system on an annual basis. No exceptions, is what it is. That's the agreed upon number. Step number two is to develop a criteria for selection into that group. What are the skill sets we need? What are, you know, set the criteria, whatever those criteria are, to get selected into that group. Number three is to actually have a set of enforcement policies that guarantee one and two are adhered to. That's what an immigration policy looks like, a good immigration policy, not just a whim of the moment based on something that's going on in the world. Sorry. Unfortunately, our adversaries realize that our immigration policies are not being adhered to or not doing as well as we need to be doing to vet who's coming in, and people, bad guys, are using those seams in our system to infiltrate their people in. We have to stop that. We have to know who's in our country, who's coming to our country, and if someone can't verify who they are, well, sorry, we are in, it would be like in the old days, you had a castle with a moat around it, then you had the drawbridge that came down, and the, you know, when there were people standing outside, the person in charge's messenger came out and took notes, you know, walked back in, decided, and they'd say, okay, 1, 3, 7, you get in, the rest of you, sorry. You know, I mean, that's very medieval, but the bottom line is we have people using our immigration system to roll their forces in who want to harm us, want to hurt us, want to take us down.
Would you be comfortable with a policy like that, that if you have 100, say if there's 10,000 people that wanted to come in, and in that 10,000 people, maybe 20 people that would slip in, that could mean us harm, to turn the 10,000 people away so that the 20 that could mean us harm don't get in? Because, it's sort of like rationing out food. Eventually, you start turning people away who need a home.
Well, the point is, you know, think about when you go through airport security. Or think about this. We'll take it out a different way. Is it good enough if your airline pilot gets 99 out of 100 landings, hits the runway?
I know this analogy.
No. You got to have it 100%. I'm sorry. I come from worlds, war fighting in the Marine Corps, being an airline pilot, and also being a small business owner in the medical equipment field. And how would you like to have your surgeon not have the right tools? No. I come from three areas where, you know, good enough is not good enough.
Jack, you were, you know, coming up on an election day here. It's going to be here before we know it. Has there been anything during these few months that you've been campaigning that are serious problems that maybe you weren't even aware of until you really got out there and found out?
I mean, serious problems that
needed to be addressed that you can address, that things that people have brought up.
Well, you know, serious problems, not so much serious problems, but for me it's been an education on issues that I may have had some visibility on but didn't know it to the depth that it needed to be known. Let me give you an example. We need to have the money appropriated to get the Sioux locks repaired and expanded. It's not only an economic requirement, but that economic requirement ties into national security because we're on a border. To me, that is my first priority when I get to Congress, is that since the studies have already been done, it's just a matter of getting the Army Corps of Engineers off of square one or taking them out of the picture, their choice, don't really care, but to get the money appropriated, get the contracts let, get that done. Sioux locks is number one on my priority for the district when it comes to making an impact right away, because the hard work's been done.
Yeah, I think it was some 30 years ago they said, yeah, get it done. It was approved. The project was approved.
But for whatever reason, the representatives or whatever, it wasn't a priority. Well, given the nature of, and that drives back to, we are blessed with so many natural resources. There is no reason that we should not be able to mine right here, have a processing plant right here, right along this shoreline, take that ore from the ground, turn it into literally a final product before it ever leaves the Great Lakes, not just mine the ore and send it out through the St. Lawrence Seaway to somewhere. Okay, that's a priority for me when it comes to building the economy, creating a beginning-to-end supply chain, if you will, that ends up in a finished product. And okay, so maybe it's a copper junction piece for some kind of a circuit board or whatever. Well, wherever it goes after that, that's fine. But that's a finished product.
If people want to know about General Jack Bergman's campaign, how do they do that?
Well, there's a couple of ways. Number one, if you like to read, go out to Bergman for Congress, www.bergman4, as in F-O-R, not F-O-U-R, or the number 4, bergman4congress.com. And if they want to reach out to the campaign, 231-944-5878 is the number that reaches into the campaign. And there's other sub-numbers down there, depending on what you want to know about. But the best way is just look on the website at Bergman for Congress. And please, everyone, please vote on November the 8th, because you honor the service of the men and women who protected that right to vote. I'd prefer you vote for me, but the bottom line is, please vote, because you honor all those folks.
Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks, Rick.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.